graduate class of energy and environment theory from ASU, and we're speaking with Kyle Soleri about his concepts related to energy and environment, and I suppose that may be a good place to start. Is from your point of view, how would you define environment? This might take the right time.
Well, it depends on how far off you want to reach with your connections.
Yeah, maybe we should just start from an individual point of view and then go as far afield as our global responsibilities should take us.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have the very immediate environment, which is, it starts with your clothing and goes into your home and your place of activities and social connections. And whatever is on whatever you are dependent as far as the daily cycles of life, economic, social, political, cultural, religious. But that's already beyond the immediate moment, somehow. And then you can extend your boundaries and include the nation, the species, the species, the world, and then the cosmos.
And I suppose we ought to, before taking that any further, ought to identify how you would describe environment, energy, particularly as it relates to the environment definition.
Well, it's basically that element which is always present, is always being in use whenever we act. Since we are alive, we constantly act. So being alive means to be consumers. And if we don't forget that, so when we speak of energy, it speaks in terms of large chunks of energy that we might need specifically for cooking a meal, or moving a car, or getting something implemented, but just the biological existence means energy.
So, to paraphrase, you equate it with being alive. And with
that energy means aliveness, but life needs energy. Without energy, there is no possibility of life. So it's one of the staples by which we exist.
Why do you not associate it with liveliness? It would seem like the quality of energy would have to do with the quality of life and liveliness.
Well, if you take the cosmos as the object, then you find out that basically the cosmos is not alive unless you are an animistic person. So the cosmos is an immense, non-living system. And it's an energetic system. But within this cosmos, which is not alive, you have specks of liveliness which are making use of the energy which is in the cosmos. So energy is fundamentally a non-living phenomenon. Of this non-living phenomenon, there are tiny particles which are made use by the living in order to exist, procreate, transform, evolve, and so on.
Now, the class is composed primarily of architects and engineers, and you at least had a beginning as an architect. I wonder if we could talk about, in general terms, about professional responsibilities, particularly as it relates to what our own developed talents are. Mm-hmm. For instance, how do you see your responsibilities or ambitions in relationship to energy?
Well, maybe I'll try to read 2 pages. It's going to be quick. It's going to be painful.
Got those.
Well, this was a statement that had to be contained within 5 minutes. It was the structure of a meeting in San Francisco for what they called the Jamboree, the Convolution Jamboree. So we had 5 minutes each speaker to state or whatever you want to state.
Would you like to discuss it after each paragraph? That'd be the way to
put it. Sure. Overall, read it all, and then we can get back to it.
The first paragraph is a single sentence. Because of the birth of consciousness within a quite possibly meaningless universe, and because consciousness is mindful of values, reality might now be seeking and pursuing meaning. You're implying there that there's something very timely about.
Well, by timely, I mean on this solar system, 2-3 millions of years, the appearance of consciousness.
But you see that as being very much of the present,
yeah.
That time span.
And very momentous.
Yes. My fundamental hypothesis is that reality, equipped with consciousness, is attempting to create its own semen. This reverses theological thinking head to toe. That which religion places at the origin, the seed, the divine power, the fountainhead, is seen at the end instead. Cosmogenesis, as the word says, is the creation of genes, the ultimate genes of the cosmos in this case. Such process entails the total consumption of the media available, the physical cosmos itself. Then, at the final juncture of consummation, the cosmos would replay itself completely, namely resurrection, as any good seed replays itself in the organism it contains. I am not peddling the truth, I am presenting an hypothesis. Why, and why one such as this? If I had more time, I would follow this line of reasoning. If it is a fact that equity, justice, truth, beauty, and grace are the real longing of conscious life, then this eschatological hypothesis might be the only one true to such longing. And if this were to be proven, then the imperative of consciousness clearly would be the dedication, full and unwavering, to the development of this ultimate seed, this divine occasion, pure, total, unimaginable. According to this hypothesis, truth does not exist. It is in the process of being created. The same is true of justice, perfection, beauty, and grace. The embryonic stage of all of these at present explains the existence of injustice, squalor, suffering, disgrace, and ugliness. The human existential dilemma is the discrepancy between anticipation and the context in which we live and act. We dream of perfection, and we get imperfection. We dream of justice, and we experience inequality. We dream of grace, and we live in squalor. maybe before I go any further, and maybe you discuss this as on the second page, your concept of sort of turning the theological process head to toe, you don't describe beginnings, you're only describing endings or conclusions with, mm-hmm. as far as you've gone.
Well, that's a very short statement. The assumption is that, and again, I'm not telling the truth, but my assumption is that the beginning is not at all divine. It's a very mass energy in the beginning. So there isn't a guideline or a divine guidance which is pre-existent to the cosmogenesis. That divinity can be a consequence of the genesis, not a causa prima of this genesis. So what the religious mind sees at the beginning, I would postulate at the end, and I call that the capacity of the human mind to anticipate and to simulate perfection, or whatever seems to be desirable.
But in terms of beginnings, you don't have any...
The Big Bang.
The Big Bang, but it's a dirty bang.
It's very dirty, it's a very dull bang, probably, because it's only with mass time and space energy. Mm-hmm. Mass energy, space time.
Okay.
So in that sense, I'm against the notion of an animistic universe. The universe is creating itself into an animated organism or system, but not because it was such as the origin, but because it might become such at the end.
Mm. So Adam and Eve have no...
Adam and Eve are symbols of consciousness appearing in the evolutionary process.
In the Garden of Eden?
That I mean is a fantasy which we fantasize more because it's a very nice notion. It's a fantasy.
Well, except that according to your plan or proposal, it does represent a goal.
Not the Garden of Eden, it's something quite different. It's a seed. That's what we call the Omega Seed, which is a is a genetic pattern which contains all of the past, which is the evolutionary process. Mm-hmm.
But to that, from that point of view, then it's very cyclical, and it tends to close back on itself in the same way that you identify the seed recreates itself.
What you find at the end, in a way, is a message, which is the conclusion of the consumption of the media. So you begin with the media, the physical universe, and you end up with a message. And the gap between the two is the evolutionary process.
Mm-hmm.
And time is the parameter which is needed in order to develop this transformation of the media into the message. So the consumption of time is this total metamorphosis of reality. And since you have consumption of time, at the end you have everything present, which has been before, so that's the notion of selection.
Let me continue. The amount of truth represented by the past is known in very tiny parcels. Even more distressing, the bulk of truth does not yet exist because it is stored in that which does not exist, the future. Therefore, we know that we do not know, namely the past, and we also know that we cannot know, namely the future. And so, since the resolution of the cosmic puzzle is in the remoteness of a distant and far from granted future, anguish is in the very nature of conscious life. In the absurd case that we should have access to knowledge, capital K, creation would stop, life would be extinguished, time, namely change, would end. This is a worry we need not waste time on. But truth might come about through the self-creational process. Therefore, time will be consumed. When this cosmogenesis is concluded, the cosmos will have achieved the creation of its own seed, because time will be no more. It will be the seed of resurrection. This is the total recall of the evolutionary process of cosmogenesis. The consequence of this conclusion will be justice, beauty, and grace in full. Because of the retroactive nature of the Omega seed, namely timeless, every occasion will have found its absolute fitness within the totality, as well as the radiant and living knowledge of its own value. This is a skeletal explanation of my eschatological hypothesis. In building the small town of Arcosanti in central Arizona, we are trying to be congruent with that hypothesis, so as to add an infinitesimal brick to the construction creation of the ultimate seed. In other words, we are pursuing the urban effect because it is the most comprehensive process by which truth, justice, congruence, and beauty can be sought. The reason is simple. Cosmogenesis is a process of complexification profound beyond the capacity of the most fervid imagination. The urban mode is the prototypical structure for fostering such a process. The urban effect is not a human invention. It is the very common mean by which life itself goes about existing, persevering, reproducing, and evolving. Evolution is the urban effect imposed upon non-life by life, and imposition by the exception, life upon the rule, non-life. Based on the urban effect, based on the urban effect and congruent with its nature, we are trying to establish a better environmental coherence, a better use of the resources of the sun. We are trying to reduce isolation, alienation, segregation, greed, intolerance, and prejudice. We are battling the mediocrity of a society hell-bent on consumerism. We hope you want to get to know the project. The task is enormous, and the need and the help is needed. Did you discuss this then after you presented it?
No, you didn't have time. Was it like a show?
Yeah. Well, did anyone discuss it?
No, I had some comments.
What were the comments?
They asked him about Schweiker and his wife. They said, now we got your point, because I debated with them some of those points before. But they said that this was, since they had some notion about it, they felt this was clarifying to them what I was trying to do. The comment that I remember.
Mm. Well, there were other speakers presenting other papers. I wonder whether there was any congruence between some of those presentations and this.
I don't know. I'm not sure there was some. There were maybe 30 or so speakers. And I watched maybe a dozen. And I felt that some of those were really, really worthless. But I think they're going to appear all in the next issue of Revolution. So, interesting.
In this paper, you mentioned Arcosanti. And identify it as being a kind of speck toward this evolutionary process. You don't define it here where you identify evolutionary processes and cosmogenesis. Maybe you'd like to say something about the whatever the hidden pattern is of this kind of evolutionary process.
That mainly is the idea that consciousness, it's a very relevant phenomenon, and we are the carrier of this consciousness, not least in the solar system. And consciousness deals very, very basically with the process of time. We make time, in fact we produce something which is different from time, we make duration by the very fact of existing and becoming. In this process of existing and becoming deals among many parameters, it deals with this aspect of the complexity. The more consciousness is present, the more complexity is present. Or you can make some kind of a graph where complexity and consciousness and self-consciousness move parallel. An increase in consciousness means an increase in complexity and so on. So of the many parameters which are making reality and bringing out complexity as one of the very crucial ones, because it gives an idea of where time is taking us. It's not taking us toward the simplicity of the Garden of Eden, it is taking us toward the complexity of divinity. So whenever we think in terms of doing and performing, we better keep in mind this fact, which I think is a fact. That is not the simple that we are seeking, but it's the complex. Because the complex is where the intensity of life resides, and where more and more we're going to move into. Maybe to give a quick twist to this scenario, I would suggest that it would be very, very, very funny if evolution came up with this tremendous invention, which we are an immensely complex machine, for the sake of simplicity. Evolution came up with this kind of phenomenon, which is immensely complex, because in that direction, it is where grace is going to exist, to develop. If the opposite were true, then we would be the virus, the very simple organism would be closer to the meat. God would be a very simple world, something like that. Just happened that when we think in terms of divinity, we think in terms of something infinitely complex.
Just to translate that to a very crass level, that implies, in terms of the design of buildings, buildings which will be increasingly complex.
The urban effect, as I use the term, is that kind of process by which this complexification of reality comes about in a more substantial way. Because you're not dealing with individuals, you're dealing with association of individuals, so you have, in a way, an exponential phenomenon of complexification which appears. So the community turns out to be one of those manifestations of this complexity employable miniaturization paradigm that we have to deal with. And the urban effect, it's that kind of condition or situation where the consciousness and intensity and sensitivity and all those things are eventually going to be exponentially developed. And that's the importance of the city, not as an instrument for economic development, not as an instrument for control of people and things, but as an instrument for transcendence. And if we forget that, I think we do not know what the meaning of the city is at all. Our buildings are part of an environment, and most of the time buildings are part of the habitat. So they are particles, they are fragments of this urbanism that is attempting to develop itself and perform itself.
But just to make an argument from this, then this implies that the larger and more complex a city is, potentially, the further along the evolutionary path it is.
Yeah, the problem we have is that we get mixed up between the complex and the complicated. And the complicated very often is not very complex. In fact, it's complicated because complexity hasn't been as yet developed within it. And technology is a very good example. The technology is a very simple-minded way of affirming the importance of acting upon the environment. But instead of acting from a biological position, which is a very subtle one, is an action by a technological position, which is a very segregational one. So technology, in its own simple-mindedness, solves problems as they were caged in separate compartments. And it's very effective in this, within that frame of reference, but unfortunately it's a frame of reference which is very limited and very limiting. So whenever we consign ourselves to technology or to technocracy, we are in danger of unwinding complexity into complicatedness. Into the complicated.
Could you be more specific in terms of giving some illustrations of the difference between complexity and complicatedness?
Well, you take a cat, and you're in the presence of a very complex phenomenon. You take a submarine, and you're in the presence of a very complicated phenomenon. One is in a propelled, self-reproducing, terribly subtle, cycles closer. The other is an outer propelled, unable to reproduce itself, opening cycles and never closing them. So,
but in effect, that kind of discrimination could be made about any comparison of animistic objects like cats versus man-made objects such as submarines.
Or the city.
Yeah.
So the question is, if there is any reasonable foundation for us to be Homo Faber, to be makers, or should we retreat into ourselves and remain biologically limited to the animal action performance. My notion is, it's not my notion, it's many people's notion, that technology is only an extension of biotechnology, but since it's very primitive and very young, still very, very simple. So we have to deal with it with caution and with open minds and prudence, you know, and distinguish between what's feasible and what's desirable, which is a distinction that we don't make. then we look at the market, and then we decide what to do.
Can you identify any environments, design environments, which you would admire in terms of their complexity and not in terms of their complicatedness?
Yeah. I think any settlement that has been performing for generations probably represents a very good example of complexity in social, political, economic, cultural terms. But as any other kind of man-made things, it's imperfect, limited, infantile, arrogant. They can make a long list.
But from that point of view, then a new settlement such as Arpizanti has
tremendous handicaps.
Yeah, but the most the grossest one is the lack of time.
Yeah,
is the fact that it is new.
Yeah, at the same time, since we're engaged in transformation of what exists, we have to try to find guidelines so that some of those transformations might offer the alternative or options, and to reject the access to options, that it's a very undemocratic situation. So when a society has the means of experimenting and prototyping, I think it becomes an imperative that society engages in prototyping. Because that's the only way by which we can really develop new options. And now, since we are very clear about the evils of the human settlement, at least in physical terms, it should be easy enough to try to amend the most evident evils by incorporating in one system changes which are doing that. And in our case, there are five or six items which are quite evident. One is the environmental impact. The other is the use of resources, including energy. Another one is the water pollution, waste. And the other one, probably the most important, is segregation, isolation. So,
maybe we should talk a little bit more about your actual experiment in a large environment, namely Arpizanti, and your premise that the plumbing comes first, that the hardware is necessary before you get the performance. Do you think that the place is mature enough yet to be able to identify any distinction about life there versus somewhere else?
No, there are aspects which are in a way necessary. We are trying to make a virtual. I don't know if we are succeeding, but one aspect is that the means are very limited. So by necessity, we have to try to be prudent. And that's a necessity which is a very important one. In fact, I believe that what we are doing, the aspect of value might be one of the most important contributions we might be making. If we get to a point where we can tell ourselves, the affluent, that life can be quite good without this consumer binge yearning. And it's important to tell ourselves which we are in this avalanche of consumerism, so we are the ones that have to change our behavior probably is not the proof that we never had a connection with the consumerist society. That should change.
How do you define, well, you've identified one quality, the possibility that the frugality might become a byword. I'm wondering if you could generalize in any other way about what an archaeological standard might be in terms of human life.
Well, one example would be that instead of developing for each individual, for each family group, all those things that are we think are necessary in order to be respectable and have a good life, by rearranging the topography and the physical habitat, we might find out that many of the things that we think are indispensable are not only not indispensable, but they are obstacles to self fulfillment. A good example is the automobile. If you can find an environment where the automobile becomes useless, we get rid of a tremendous waste.
Although, after all, that's been done for most of man's life.
Yeah, but at that time, the ability to do other things wasn't there. Now we know that we have the ability to transform, let's say, reality. Unfortunately, we are wasting our capacity in things which are senseless.
Just taking one step further than the idea that modern life has given us a lot of options that we never had before. Don't these options change the potentials in relationship to urban effect? For instance, Mumford in The City and History tries to project a future which is very decentralized and which is heavily dependent in terms of energy on the electrical grid, and which is dependent for communications on television and telephone and variants.
Isn't it strange that Mumford comes up with that idea? Because since he's a humanist, you would immediately believe that it cannot equate the personal contact with the remote contact through electronics. We keep telling ourselves that the city is becoming less and less important because we can move ideas instead of moving hardware. But that's something which refers to only a small part of what our needs are. It doesn't refer practically ever to the most important part of what our needs are, which is personal contact and then the actual performances. So I cannot have a meal by television, nor I can have a real encounter by phone. If I want to make babies, no way is for the moment to use the phone or the television set. And then there is naturally the whole support system, which is feeding in and feeding out, which is, again, cannot be done through cable or through vibration we have for this for many, many generations, I'm sure. So the need of an environment which is meaningful and substantial and rich is not diminished by the fact that we have the electronic medias. In fact, those can be enhancers and it might be able to enrich this experience, but per se, they're only, part of the picture of learning, speech, communication, memory, sense of history all the time.
So the concept of a decentralized post-industrial world for you would be a step backward.
Well, it depends what we mean by decentralized. If we say that it doesn't make sense for a continent like the United States to have two enormous centers of life, like the Eastern Seaboard and the Western Seaboard, and then maybe Chicago and other areas surrounding it, then I would say that we have to decentralize. By decentralizing, we mean that we have to break down the community, the village, the town, the city, and we go back into the wilderness. Maybe Thoreau was advocating that, and we say that we are mistaken. So it seems to me that we have to develop very, very intense and lively centers, and the size of those centers is up for grabs. It depends on so many factors. But those centers need containment, because without containment you end up by having Los Angeles or Phoenix or those Mexico City's phenomenons, which are probably going to be very destructive. But containment doesn't mean isolation, it's just about the opposite. Because as I keep saying, it's through containment that you develop intensity. It's through intensity that you can broadcast and receive. So by dissolving my physiological structure, I do not obtain integration, I obtain disintegration. So it's by containing myself that I can communicate with you. So.
But can't you identify in the phenomenon of the modern city, the urban effect that you describe, that cities have been growing and continue to grow at abnormal rates? The living conditions are steadily deteriorating as a result, and it would seem as though that's a kind of self-destructive mode which is turning back on itself against some of the concepts that you've tried to represent.
Well, isn't that because we feel that even by any kind of discipline is infringing on our freedom? Once we put that up as a slogan, then there's nothing we can do with it, because we have to accept the fact that anybody can do just about anything he or she pleases. Once that's the decision, as a democratic society, then we are in for disaster. Because, again, we should turn to the biological and find out how the biological clicks, and then try to see if we can transfer that into the post-biological and see if we can make something click. And evidently, one thing that is very clear, very apparent in the biological is that there's tremendous discipline, incredible discipline that any living system is submitted to. Without that discipline, there's no possibility of survival or even creation of anything. So it's not sufficient to set up some very generic rules and then say, well, we are intelligent creatures. Through self-interest, we're going to develop the best of worlds. It doesn't work that way. We need